Chapter 5. Secundus opened his eyes. Birds were singing, loudly. They did not sound as sweet as birds were supposed to. He thought that they sounded rather bad-tempered. He frowned vaguely in the direction of them, sitting up and scrubbing at his eyes. For a moment, he felt caught between waking and dreaming. He was very surprised to be alone in his bed. It was a shock, as though he had been plunged into cold water. A moment ago, he had been comfortably squashed between those warm, lazy bodies, and now... Now, as he gazed around his spare, neat, quiet, unassuming bedroom, with its stacks of books and its scholarly air and the small marks of genteel poverty, he felt a sudden surge of panic that the dream had not been real. For the man who lived in this room, he thought, with his meek and half-rate mind, with his turned sleeves, with his pedantic annotations... Such a dream could only ever be a dream. To even think that one of the great Argentine magicians, to think that Childermas, who with his dark looks and brooding disposition was very like a poetic hero from a book, and who, in addition, was proud and learned and mysterious and sarcastic, it was quite absurd. It was quite piteously foolish. He imagined Childermas's expression, the arch disbelief, the faint hint of scorn. You? His imaginary Childermas said. A sense of bitter shame and disappointment overwhelmed him for a moment. He buried his face in his hands. It was real, he thought, and yet it could not have been real. And he stewed in an unhappy muddle for quite a long while, paralyzed by fear and longing and other things he could not name. There was a knock at the door. Secundus was frozen by it. For the length of quite a long pause, he did not respond. Then, yes, he ventured in a small voice. The doorknob turned, and the door opened minutely. Here, too, there was a long pause, though Secundus could not read the hesitation. At last, Childermas slipped into the room. He was in his shirt sleeves, looking extremely rumpled, as though he had just crawled out of bed. But then Childermas always looked extremely rumpled. They did not look at one another. There was an uncomfortable silence. Childermas stared at the floor. Secundus twisted his hands and his bed covers. Eventually, Childermas said, "You appear to have angered your Dunnocks." Secundus had to think about this for quite a while to understand it. "Is a Dunnock a type of bird?" "Yes, they are not usually so vocal."
"Oh," Secundus said.
He picked nervously at a loose bit of thread. He could not help feeling that, in a moment, something horrible would happen. He was tempted to forestall it by fleeing the room. Indeed, had he not been in his nightshirt, he might have done so.
"So,"
Childermas said. He shifted from foot to foot. Secundus caught him darting a glance upwards, a covert glance, oddly uncertain. "I do not suppose that..." "Yes," Secundus said, very quickly.
"That is to say..."
He fidgeted further. He said, with difficulty, "I dreamt about you." "Yes," Secundus said. He had meant this to mean continue, but he could not say it without putting his longing into it, so that it came out meaning something else altogether. "Yes, yes, it was real. Yes, I want." He raised his glance to Childermas. For a moment their eyes met. Secundus felt a tangible physical jolt, a sense of something electric falling into place. He had meant to look down again, but found he could not.
"It was not a dream," Childermas said softly. His eyes were soft, too.
Though they were still very guarded, Secundus could glimpse the shadow of that bare, wondering self beyond them, the self that he most wanted to draw out towards him. He saw that he would have to be the braver of them, that he had, perhaps, less to lose than did Childermas. Secundus said, "It was a dream. But it was a dream I shared. That is, I believe we shared it. I am in the habit of sharing dreams." Childermas said, rather wryly, "I am becoming aware." Secundus flushed. "I hope the dream was, I hope you did not find it unpleasant. I know in sleep we are sometimes not who we would choose to be. I wholly understand if you feel, now you have woken, that you should not have... or that you do not wish." In answer, Childermas crossed the room. He stood beside Secundus's bed and regarded him with a mixture of ferocity and fondness.
Did you truly think I would cast you off so soon?
I do not know, Segundus confessed. I hardly know what to think.
He looked down at his hands clenched upon the coverlet. It is rather disconsolate to wake after I've been dreaming and find myself alone in my bed. It casts one into low and questioning spirits.
Well, Childemas said, there is a remedy for that.
And he lifted up the bedclothes just as though he had been invited, and, casting a careful glance at Segundus, climbed beneath them. Segundus thought perhaps he should have been piqued by this. Childemas was always going where he had not been asked to go, but at the same time he seemed always to be where he was wanted, because he knew that he was wanted, before even Segundus knew it, as though he possessed a cryptic map of Segundus's desires, as though he were following this map, though he could not quite read it. Segundus lay down beside him and drew him close. It was the first time he had ever held anyone in this bed. It was not so different from holding someone in a dream, yet all the same he felt very glad. Childermas's skin was still warm from sleep, and as Segundus curled against him, resting his head on his chest, he made a vague, contented sound that was half a sigh.
I was afraid that I had invented it, Segundus murmured. The dream?
You have a high opinion of your imagination, Childemas said.
Segundus smiled soundlessly against him.
It was rather good, wasn't it?
Childemas said grudgingly.
It was not bad, I suppose.
Segundus made an indignant sound.
It could not have been bad. You had given me what I wanted just by being...
Oh, Segundus said.
He held Childemas closer.
I did not know. But I am glad.
Glad. That was how to describe the emotion, the current of contentment running through him. It made him feel light and heavy at the same time, drowsy but also buoyed up by happiness. He could have fallen asleep like that, and it would have been pleasant to do so and wake in Childermas's arms. Indeed, he could think of nothing that he would like better. Only, the crescendo of birdsong had swelled again by the window. It was unpleasantly raucous and did not permit sleep.
Childermas groaned. Do we know a spell to make them quiet?
Segundus was rather pleased by this first-person plural, implying, as it did, a certain shared and permeable knowledge that lay between them. He said, it requires pledging them an object.
I'm going to pledge them a shoe in a minute.
You're not wearing shoes, and you may not hurl one of mine out the window.
How severely you restrict me, Childermas said, but he did not sound unhappy.
He sounded a little sleepy. Segundus said, we shall have to ask Miss Absalom the next time we see her. She comes and goes as she likes, I do not summon her. Or I should say, I've never tried.
No, Childermas said, I am sure you have not.
There was something amused and fond and frustrated in his voice. However, I will hazard the opinion that she would not at all mind it. Indeed, she might well be pleased if you took such an action. It is more exhausting than you realize, winning attention from you.
Segundus did not know what to say to this. He felt rather chastised. I do not think of it as a prize, you see, he said.
But it is.
I suppose I must owe you rather a backlog of attention by your lights. Segundus, feeling rather daring, gently pushed Childermas back against the bed and pinned him down, nuzzling against his neck.
Since we cannot sleep, he said, I might use this time to discharge my debts.
Childermas enthusiastically demurred to object to this. In the end, it was another hour before they left the bedroom, and even then only because they had grown very hungry. They thudded downstairs, rumpled and barefoot, in their shirt sleeves, and smiling foolishly at one another. Or rather, Segundus found his own smile foolish. Childermas's smile, he thought, was rare and solemn, like a night flower, something you had to be careful and patient to see. Even at its most giddy, it was like that. He caught himself watching that smile with too much intensity. How had he never noticed, he wondered. Or perhaps all along he had known at some secret level. All along he had resisted the impulse to cultivate that smile, fearing to want what was beyond his reach. Childermas said, over a slice of Madeira cake, You are staring at me like a bird intent upon stealing my breadcrumbs.
Startled, Segundus laughed.
I am what? You have even tilted your head in that self-same way. Now you are fluffing your feathers in indignation.
I am not fluffing my feathers! I do not have any feathers!
Happiness suits you, I think, Childermas said unexpectedly. Then he looked away, abashed, his cheeks faintly colored. Sigundus touched his hand. The kitchen was full of sunlight. The house itself seemed obscurely happy. The branches of the wild pear tapped gently on the window. Doves were calling, low and peaceful and sweet, and there were other bright, chortled sounds of birdsong, a hint of magic in everything growing. Not precisely music, in the way that magic was never precisely music, but not precisely any other thing. Like a mixture of music and aroma and the vision of something you could never quite see. It was in the stones of the house and the dust motes in the air, and in Childermas linking their hands together, leaning back in his chair, saying nothing. "Stay for the summer," Sigunda said. He had not planned to say it. "What, so you can put me to work in your garden?" Sigunda said. "Among other things." Childermas did not answer at once, but he did not remove his hand from the table. After a while, he said, "I could see my way to it, I suppose." Sigunda smiled, and he knew for certain his smile was now foolish. He did not mind terribly.
"Good," he said. "Good."
Sigundus thought a great deal about summoning Miss Absalom. He thought about it for the next 4 or 5 days, although he did not think about it so much as this might suggest, since he was in bed with Childermas for much of those days. Not purely engaged in carnal acts, though it was thoroughly delightful to learn from Childermas's body what pleased him. He thought that Childermas did not know a great deal about what pleased him. Childermas was different from Miss Absalom, as a lover, in most respects. Quieter, less forward, somehow reticent in his motions. He was slow and careful and very intent, and looked at Sigundus all the time with steady, dark eyes, his gaze so heated that Sigundus began to fear he might melt. But just as often they were tangled in the bed linens, half-drowsing, talking about some crux in a line of a lost book of magic until one or both of them fell asleep, or lazing on the rug in the library, scouring magical journals for silent spells. They had tried 3 so far on the recalcitrant birds, but none appeared to have any effect. Or, to much noise of complaining, Sigundus dragged Childermas out to the garden, where he rudely declined to speak to the plants, and instead stretched out in the sun, smoking his pipe, failing to look even a little unhappy with his situation. Butterflies were much taken with him for some reason, and determinedly followed him about in pale yellow clouds, attempting to land in his hair or on his sleeves. A number of snails investigated him with slow suspicion, and the water spirit burbled happily, and the roses posed a number of complicated questions about him to Sigundus, which he was not sure he fully understood. Plants had quite a different way of seeing the world, flowers especially, and they seemed to have a great many vague thoughts about roots and blossoms. "He's not going to put down roots," Sigundus told them. "He is not a tree." He had a clear sense the roses were miffed at him for this answer. He sighed. What extraordinary maintenance roses required! How woundable they were! The eyebright and marjoram from either side of the bushes agreed. "Meanwhile, have we any more of the Madeira cake?" Childermas inquired, wafting away a flurried snowstorm of butterfly wings. "We," Sigundus repeated. "I do not see what you have done to be hungry." Indeed, Childermas was the picture of idleness, with the cuffs of his sleeves rolled to his elbows, shading the sun from his eyes with one hand. At Sigundus's words, he acquired a lazy, vulpine look and said, "I can change that." He made to pull Sigundus down to him, but Sigundus said, exasperated, "Not in the garden." So they relocated to the parlor instead, where it was cooler and shady, and where Childermas pushed Sigundus gently against one floral wall before simply standing and staring hungrily at him. Sigundus said, his breath coming short, "Is this your idea of labor? I confess it seems sedentary to me, sir."
"Does it?" Childermas said.
He drew closer. Still, they were not touching. Sigundus could feel the heat of him inches away, smell the hint of the sun, the garden's greenness. But Childermas only looked at him with those dark, dark eyes. It was a look that felt like being slowly drunk in. When at last he touched Sigundus, the touch was equally slow, a single hand laid against one side of his face, thumb stroking softly against his chin. Sigundus pushed into it, wanting more.
But no, Childermas said. Like this. He slipped a hand into Segundus's breeches. At the first touch of fingers against his prick, Segundus gasped. He had been hard already. He leaned forwards, but Childermas held him back with a hand gripping his face and watched him intently. Watched as Segundus breathed faster, as he flushed, as he twitched. Childermas stroked him unhurriedly. He paused at one point and withdrew his hand. Segundus made a complaining noise, and pressed it to Segundus's mouth. Segundus, after a brief hesitation, met his eyes and then licked the broad palm of it. They did not look away from one another. Segundus let his tongue slide between the fingers, mark out the little lines and dips where proximal flanges became middle, became distal. He had an anatomical education. Childermas had beautiful hands. And then took the tip of a finger in his mouth, sucking hard. Childermas took his hand away again and returned it to its work. His own face was very flushed now, but he moved as carefully as he had before, coaxing Segundus towards louder sounds of pleasure, causing him to drop his head against the wall and clench his fists. "Oh," Segundus said, feeling the tension overtake him. His legs were trembling. I cannot." He expelled a huge gasp of breath. He could not focus, through the pleasure, on staying upright. He thought his legs would collapse like pliable reeds. Still, Childermas watched him with the same intensity of focus. It was that, the weight of the desire in his gaze, that made Segundus feel so hot and lightheaded. He pushed forward into Childermas's hand, making choked noises with every slide against his palm. Childermas closed his hand more tightly, moistening his lips with his tongue. It was that, for some reason, that little motion, the flicker of his tongue, and the suggestion of hunger in it, that caused Segundus to spasm his hips and arch his back and climax. He spent himself into Childermas's hand. He did collapse, then, or rather slid down the wall, aware that his face must be blotchy with heat and his clothes were a mess. Childermas supported him, joining him on the carpet. "You have done more for my appetite than your own," Segundus accused when at last he had got his breath back. "Well," Childermas said, looking rather self-satisfied, "I should imagine you know how to remedy that." And indeed, Segundus did. Afterwards, when he had finished using his much-praised mouth to drive Childermas out of nonchalance, and when they had stripped off their much-dirtied clothes, on which Segundus had insisted, and were eating cake and cheese and apples in bed, Segundus said, "I have thought of summoning Miss Upsilon using Mr. Strange's spell." Childermas looked at him very calmly, taking a bite of cheese. "You do not," Segundus said. "That is, it would not upset you?" Childermas gazed at an apple thoughtfully. "I should like to resolve the bird problem," he said, "before I resort to baking them into a pie." "You cannot cook. Or if you can, you have never revealed it." "Why should I discourage you from feeding me?" Childermas said mildly. Then he continued, "No, it does not upset me. I should be most interested to speak with her. Though I imagine that speaking is not what you had in mind." Segundus blushed. "That is not it at all," he protested. "I enjoy Miss Absalom's company. She is a very delightful woman." "I am sure she is," Childermas said, his eyebrows raised. He looked rather amused. "Truly, I do not mind it. She and I have complementary interests, I believe." "Do you?" Segundus said, a little warily. Childermas seemed pleased to be mysterious. "Well," Segundus said, "I suppose we might just summon her to ask about the birds and see where other things go from there." So when they had dressed and put the bed in order, they employed Mr. Strange's summoning spell, falling asleep, curled comfortably around each other in the afternoon sunlight. Segundus opened his eyes to find himself back in the garden. He was not, as he usually found himself when he dreamt of the garden, digging a hole. He was pruning an extraordinarily beautiful rosebush, clipping the little dead leaves off of it. It bore a number of remarkable flowers, some crimson and some an ivory cream color, others just barely blushed red. He felt extremely proud at the idea that he had grown such a rosebush, though he supposed that the rosebush itself really ought to be awarded the merit. "You did a bit of work," Miss Absalom said. Segundus turned to see her smiling at him. She was in a leaf-green dress, one that gave her eyes a very vivid emerald sparkle. Hello, he said to her. You did come when I called you.
She looked amused. That is how the spell works, after all.
You have not been put out of temper, I meant to say. I was not sure if you would be.
Not at all.
Being dead, she said, is not like you suppose. I can guarantee it. One never runs short of time to do things, and one may quite often be in two places at once. The rules are very different. If I did not like you, I should find you a tiresome nuisance, I suppose. But in fact, I like you.
I'm glad, Segunda said, a little shyly. Then he looked around.
But where is Childermas? We had intended to ask you a magical question. I do not know where he could have got to.
The shutters of the kitchen window creaked open, and Childermas leant himself out of them. He was contemplatively eating a small iced cake with a bright pink spun sugar rose on it.
You have just eaten, Segunda said in exasperation.
Your cakes do not have decorations, Childermas noted, by way of explanation.
Then you will not require me to bake you any more?
I did not say that.
Miss Absalom pressed a hand to her mouth to muffle her laughter.
Perhaps I ought to change the subject, she said.
What was your question?
We desire to silence a number of birds. They appear to harbor a vendetta. I cannot think why. She frowned.
Have you asked them?
They are very angry, Segunda said doubtfully. I do not think they would respond.
One ought always to try that first. If they do not, I can think of a number of solutions. But come here, I have not even kissed you yet.
He did, and she did. A sweet, sharp peck accompanied by a very pleasant embrace. Segunda stroked a hand on the low silk back of her dress. She was so beautiful, he thought, like the summer to Childermas's winter, bright and dazzling where Childermas was darkly joyous. He had not known how he would feel upon seeing her again, and he was surprised at how happy he found himself. Miss Absalom said over his shoulder,
"And you, John Childermas, how is your reading going?"
Childermas said, a little sulkily, "A man may have a holiday, may he not?" She laughed.
"Do not be concerned, I will keep your secret, so long as you do not vex me too much. You ought not to, anyway. After all, you are living in my house now."
Childermas looked subtly alarmed.
"You are misinformed," he said. "I am merely staying for the summer."
"Are you?" Miss Absalom said. But she chose not to comment any further on the matter.
"You do not mind?" Segundus asked. His life seemed to be full of these sorts of negotiations lately, trying to settle every person and object in their right place. It was all very complicated. But he felt somehow there was a pattern, if he could only work it out day by day. There was some way to get the little threads to weave together so that the picture they formed was clear and complete. Though he had the faintest sense that he would not quite ever see that picture, that he would go on forever grasping at it, seeing only the smallest, nearest pieces.
"Of course not," Miss Absalom assured him. "It is your house as well, and we shall get along together."
"And you will still visit me?"
"Because," he said, a little abashed by his honesty, "I would be very sorry not to see you any more. You have brought me so much delight, and you have taught me so much, and I should miss you if you were gone."
She looked at him with a great deal of fondness and a tenderness he had not quite seen before, a very serious form of tenderness.
"Dearest John," she said, "shall I ever make you believe in the joy that you bring to other people?"
"You may try," Childermas interjected. "He is very resistant to it."
"Well," Miss Absalom said, "it is real, and I prefer to keep it. Whether or not you choose to bring him," she gestured toward Childermas with a queenly dismissiveness, but also a hint of laughter,
"is your prerogative. I suppose I can tolerate him."
"He is very bad-tempered," Segundus confided, "and he drinks the good wine, but he has his redeeming qualities."
Childermas rolled his eyes, but he was smiling crookedly. Miss Absalom gazed affectionately at Segundus and kissed him on the cheek.
"Go and settle with your birds," she told him. "All is well. I shall visit you when you have more time to sleep, and then..."
Her eyes flickered slowly along his body, sending a faint erotic jolt through him.
"You may settle with me. At length."
Segundus felt his face burning.
"I look forward to it," he said.
"Leave a bit of him for me,"
Childemas commented dryly. Miss Absalom shot a naughty, flirtatious look at him.
Jealous, darling? Would you like your own arrangement?
No, he's mine, Secundus objected. Then he flinched, realizing the injustice of this. That is... You heard the man, Childemas said. He seemed unruffled. In fact, there was perhaps a flash of pleasure when he looked at Secundus, a hint of satisfaction. His eyes lingered. He said, On that note, if you'll excuse us. Miss Absalom flapped her hands. Oh, go along, if you're not going to let me watch. Go on, off with you. So Childemas made a gesture with his hand, and all at once the dream began sinking around them, in the curious way that magical dreams did. Secundus was aware of a strong sense of Childemas's magic, dark, autumnal, and firelit, like sparks in the blue dusk, and then he was stirring, blinking, waking up in the bed. He rolled over to find Childemas watching him with sleepy eyes. Childemas laid a heavy hand at the side of his head, and leaned in and kissed him very seriously and slowly. Secundus brought his arms up to pull Childemas towards him, and they lay there warmly tangled in each other's limbs, kissing to no particular purpose, as twilight crept slowly across Yorkshire outside the window, and the chorus of outraged birds started up again. Epilogue. Childemas frowned. They say you are a dictator and a tyrant. Secundus stared at him, then at the sullen-looking crowd of dunnocks that fill the branches of the hawthorn tree. The birds had refused to speak to him and would communicate only with Childemas. But how have I oppressed them? He wanted to know. I have never acted against them. Indeed, I would not. Well, Childemas asked the dunnocks. A great deal of indignant chirping followed, and some hopping and flapping about of wings. Childemas rolled his eyes. They say the grouse over at some dismal farm or another informed them that you have been persecuting a group of cattle. Secundus rubbed at his temples, feeling the first stirring of a headache. Those cattle had taken themselves off to ferry without so much as a by your leave to the man who owned them. We have been over this. I was clear that they should settle the matter with the farmer. Well, Childemas said, it would appear they did not. It would appear that instead they have been blackening your name to half the county. Secundus appealed to the Donnocks.
How may I correct your misapprehension? I am not a tyrant. I am the least tyrannical of men. I believe in liberty and equality of all creatures.
Childemas coughed. Secundus suspected he was laughing at him. The Donnocks whistled, fixing their beady eyes on Secundus and hopping up and down energetically. They were really, Secundus thought mean-spiritedly, very unpleasant creatures. He ought to have let his raven chase them. They say they are willing to negotiate with the cattle, Childemas reported. They will explain matters to the cattle for a small fee.
A fee?
Seed cake. They wish to be paid in seed cake. Secundus leveled a suspicious gaze at Childemas.
I feel uncertain as to the accuracy of your interpretation, sir.
Childemas shrugged innocently. I do not say I would reject seed cake were it offered.
Secundus sighed heavily. Oh, very well. To achieve some peace and quiet at last, I suppose that is little enough to pay.
Peace and quiet, Childemas said. The corner of his mouth had curled in amusement. Admit it, you would grow quite bored of such a thing, were you in fact to achieve it. You thrive on having problems to solve.
I will certainly never lack for problems with you around, Secundus said, eyeing him severely.
No, Childemas said, with satisfaction. You will not. And he followed Secundus into the Staircross kitchen, slouching and chewing on his pipe stem, with the air of a man who was very pleased to be exactly as much of a problem as Secundus could ever have wanted. The End.